Hello and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast. Episode 12, James and Anne. Anne Stuart became Queen of England, Scotland and Ireland on the day of the death of King William III, March 8th, 1702, at the age of 37. Anne was a woman suffering the mental pain of losing all of her children in either childbirth or at a very young age, but also suffered the physical pain of her severe gout, which was often so painful she was left red-faced and sweating. A Scottish commissioner, John Clark, said the Queen was in a negligent state of dress, with her feet tied up in a poultice and some nasty bandages. As part of this, or other factors, Anne was herself often quite shy and would avoid asking or indeed answering questions in public, sticking to the most bland of pleasantries. But this shyness and infirmity was more than matched by a very determined mind, with a personality that adhered to the rituals and protocols of court. Anne never missed a cabinet meeting. She enjoyed absorbing herself in the business of court, such as meeting ambassadors, peers, nobles, and writing and signing royal letters and warrants. Anne had one major advantage to the people and nobility, of course. She was English. In her first speech to the Lords, she utilised this fact to the utmost, proclaiming, "I know my own heart to be English," and saying there was nothing she wasn't ready to do for England. Anne had hated William, so this swipe at her dead brother-in-law's Dutch origins and preoccupations set her apart from him. There was a new queen in town. There was also a new king in exile in Saint-Germain. As the young age of 13, James Francis Edward Stuart was proclaimed King James III of England and Ireland and King James VIII of Scotland. James was only recognised as monarch by France, Spain, the Papal States and his mother's home state of Modena. Mary of Modena, widow of the deposed King James II, ruled as regent given her son's youth. She dressed in mourning but was determined to help her son achieve his birthright and to ascend to the throne. But just because the Jacobite faithful were trying to come up with ideas to get their king back doesn't mean there was any progress beyond the arrival of Lord Belhaven in 1701. Belhaven had fought alongside William's forces at Killiecrankie, but he was against the Hanoverian succession after Anne, and he wanted to protect the crown of Scotland above all. At this point, Belhaven obviously felt the best way to do this was to secure the Scottish succession for James VIII. Not only would this prevent the Hanoverians from taking power, but it would also try to limit the possibility of something Belhaven and other Scots dreaded: political union with England. Union was something that had existed in a de facto state since 1603, when King James VI of Scotland had been crowned King James I of England. But Scotland and England still held distinct parliaments and legal systems, as well as churches. Since the restoration of Charles II to the throne, Scotland had occasionally chafed at rules such as the Navigation Acts that restricted trade for Scotland with the Dutch, who were a major Scottish trade partner. But Scotland's throne was still independent and could be offered to a Jacobite claimant, which could cause trouble. Belhaven was keen to have Scotland remain its own state, so his approach to Saint-Germain was to find a compromise to allow James to retake his throne. His suggestion was that James convert to Protestantism to become more palatable to the nobility. But James was far too convinced of his divine right to rule that he was steadfast to his Catholic faith. The best compromise that could be obtained was that Mary, on behalf of her son, agreed the Scottish Kirk would be free from royal interference. It wasn't the solution he wanted, but he could try and get people on side with it. The problem was there was a bigger challenge to come to their rule, in the guise of support. In 1702, Simon Fraser, the 11th Lord Lovat, arrived in the court of Saint-Germain. We'll meet him again many times, and frankly speaking, his exploits are plentiful enough to warrant a podcast series all of their own. Born in around 1670 in the Highlands, Simon Fraser was part of the Clan Fraser known as the Beaufort Frasers, a cadet branch of the family who inherited the clan leadership on the death of Hugh Fraser, the lord at the time. During the Highland War, Simon's old brother had been killed fighting the forces of King William at Killiecrankie, and so he'd become heir to the clan chieftainship. Educated in Aberdeen, he was plunged into intrigues involving their rival clan, the Mackenzies, and their allies, the Murrays of Atholl. Under the previous Fraser lord, a political marriage had been arranged between Hugh Fraser and Amelia Murray, which would make her Lady Lovat. Simon then tried himself to marry the younger Amelia Murray, but she was betrothed to a Mackenzie. Both the Mackenzies and the Murrays were trying to encroach on Fraser lands, and Simon decided that if he couldn't marry Amelia Jr., he'd marry Amelia the mother. In an episode that was as shocking then as it is now, Simon and his men burst into Castle Dooney. The young Master of Lovett seized Amelia Murray and forced her into a shotgun wedding under armed guard with a drunk priest. He then proceeded to, in some accounts, make the marriage official by raping the Dowager Lady Lovett. Given that Simon had already taken Lord Saltoun hostage and threatened to hang him in the feud with the Murrays and Mackenzies, Simon had tried to play the assault off on Amelia as he had that of Saltoun, a spirited Highland feud settling, but the Murrays were beyond enraged. They sought the army, and they raised all hell in trying to hunt down Simon. He and his father Thomas, the 10th Lord Lovett, fled their homeland and fled to the lands of the MacLeods on the Isle of Skye, Simon's mother's family. Thomas died in hiding in Dunvegan and Skye, but Simon managed to obtain a pardon in exchange for raising troops for William and Mary and gaining the patronage of the Duke of Argyll, who bought Simon some political cover. But the Murrays would not be so easily denied and instead pursued Simon Fraser through the courts, demanding justice for Lady Amelia, who was back in Atoll lands with her Murray kin. Simon had ignored a court summons that once again left him an outlaw. It was this that caused Lord Lovett to make his trip to France to ingratiate himself with the Jacobite court, aiming in restoring the Stuart son, James Francis Edward, as king, so as to return to Beaulieu and regain his lands and titles from the threats of the Murrays and the Mackenzies. When Simon arrived at Saint-Germain, he ingratiated himself to the young king and his mother by converting to Catholicism and spending time at court. Lovett sowed a tale of discontent with Anglo-Scottish relations and a proposal to look into military intervention to restore the Stuart monarchy in France. Despite Mary of Modena believing that divine intervention would provide for her son, there were others in court who wanted to be more proactive, and Fraser lobbied those for military intervention in Scotland. Eventually, James and his mother Mary gave their consent to Simon to recruit in their name, and so did King Louis XIV of France. When Lovett arrived in Scotland disguised as an exchanged prisoner of war from England, he had in his possession letters of marque signed by the Jacobite King James proclaiming any name written in as an officer in the new Jacobite army. Simon Fraser then headed to London to an audience with the Marquess of Queensberry, Secretary of State for Scotland under Queen Anne. Queensberry, like Lovett, was an enemy of the Duke of Atoll and his Murray kin. Fraser told of the plot to overthrow the government and showed a letter from Mary of Modena to the Duke of Atoll, implicating the Murrays in a Jacobite plot. Queensberry was so taken he didn't even question the discrepancies in the handwriting that some suggest Simon may have even forged himself, something confirmed by a lot of later historical accounts. The consequences of this were seismic. Atoll was forced to defend his actions and step down from government, but Lovett's pawn Queensberry paid the price, thanks to Robert Ferguson, a spy who exposed the plot, and the discovery that Queensberry had issued travel passes to a Scottish outlaw, namely Lord Lovett, who of course promptly threw Queensberry under the bus and claimed it was all his idea to destroy Atoll and Hamilton. Lovett's luck ran out on his return to France, however, as despite his claims to the contrary, he had betrayed the Jacobites. His travel companion, Johnny Murray, arrived with letters showing a rising recruitment in Scotland of clans willing to stand. But the man they called Anshonach, or the Fox in English, had burnt his bridges at the Jacobite court. King Louis was enraged not only at this deception, but the fact that Lovett had used money to buy Jacobite arms to instead throw a lavish fete in Bourges. On the orders of the French king, Lovett was imprisoned in Angoulême, having officially outstayed his welcome. The Jacobites would have to try again, because this time they trusted the wrong man. If this incident helped reinforce anything in the minds of English nobles, it was that Scottish allegiances were not always with England. Since the Act of Settlement in 1701, Scotland decided to assert its status as an independent kingdom. Passing the Act of Security, the Scots Parliament asserted its own right to define a distinct line of succession for the Scottish crown if England did not allow Scotland freedom to trade with whomever they wished. Reading between the lines, this could be seen as a threat to restore the deposed Stuarts, on top of the overt threat to stop fighting in Europe in the raging war of the Spanish Succession. This could not stand, and so the English passed the Alien Act in 1705, an act that classed Scottish nationals as foreigners in England, leaving their legal rights at risk and their property subject to forfeiture. At the same time, the English government began to pass economic sanctions on Scotland, banning importation of Scottish linen, cattle, or coal to England or any of her colonies. These economic conditions were able to be rescinded on one condition, that Scotland consent to negotiations with England to form a more permanent political union. England had desired this union for some time, but more specifically since Scotland had balked at the 1701 Act of Settlement. Of course, this had been a de facto union since King James had taken his throne, yet as we've discussed, these were still independent nations. There'd been negotiations in the past, but in 1706, England passed a preliminary act of union with Scotland. The political elite of England then used all of their capital to try and persuade the Scots nobles to sign away their nation to this new union. Some were actively pro-union. They saw the benefits of being involved with decisions and the levels of power in London. There were also, quite frankly, great sums of bribe money being thrown around to induce patriots to sign. Others agreed to sign given the inducement of Scottish commerce being granted access to English markets and the riches of foreign trade. England also vitally agreed to assume Scotland's debts, which was a boon following the financially crippling failure of the Darien scheme. That's not to say there was universal acclaim for union. Some nobles, such as the Duke of Atholl, John Murray, and Andrew Fletcher of Saltoun, were far from being anti-London or Jacobite sympathisers, but they were pro-Queen Anne, fiercely anti-union. They feared the political consequences of signing away the national independence of Scotland for short-term financial gain. The other thing to consider is that these financial benefits only really benefited the noble or merchant classes. Most of the general populace were vehemently against union, as they sided with the sovereignty arguments of Murray and Fletcher. They were also unlikely to see any of the financial benefit from that union, but since they didn't matter to the landed gentry of the merchant classes, talks and debate continued. The man in Scotland who helped ease the passage through Parliament was John Dalrymple, former Earl and now Viscount of Stair. Dalrymple was back in the royal good graces following his wilderness years stemming from his orchestration of the Glencoe massacre and being King William's fall guy for that particular event. Stair spoke with others and helped the act through Parliament but died before its passage. Stair ended his career in service to the greater kingdoms he had served, but for Glencoe and Union he earned the eternal enmity of Scots nationalists. Despite the hatred of the populace, requiring armed guards at Parliament at all points to avoid a lynch mob, there was a lack of coordinated opposition, and the Treaty of Union was ratified on January 16, 1707. Scotland's Kirk was preserved and the legal system kept distinct, but only 45 of the 155 Scottish MPs would sit in the House of Commons, and only 16 of the 160 Scots Lords would go too. And the Scots crown was vested with the House of Hanover. Opponents saw this as a Scottish takeover by England, but the numbers were against them in Parliament, as well as a leafleting campaign led by later famous author Daniel Defoe, which implored Scotland to union to share in England's prosperity. The last Lord Chancellor of Scotland, Earl Seafield, was said to remark as the Parliament in Edinburgh voted its own demise that there's an end of an old song. Queensberry was lauded by Queen Anne and awarded the title of Duke of Dover. His joy was short-lived, however, as in what Jacobites and anti-unionists would call some form of divine retribution, Queensberry had come home one day to the horror of finding his 10-year-old son roasting and eating a kitchen servant on a spit. That's actually true. You can Google it. But the kingdoms of England and Scotland were dead. Long live the Kingdom of Great Britain. Speaking from a Jacobite historical perspective, the Act of Union was a fantastic recruitment tool. The general populace felt massive anti-union resentment amongst the public, who felt the bite of English duties and imports and controls, feeling that being in North Britain was great for the haves, not so much for the have-nots. The population resented the new union so much a new kind of Jacobite nationalism formed, where Scots who, in the words of Burns, felt bought and sold for English gold, threw their lot in with James in Saint-Germain in a bid to restore the Kingdom of Scotland as an independent nation in its own right. Despite all possible indications that Jacobite rulers would intend to use Scotland merely as a stepping stone to London and ruling with two crowns as James the 7th and 2nd had and all the others before him, the Scots cried no to union and yes to the Stuart Restoration purely to thumb their noses at Anne and London. There was so much support for James that he and his French benefactors decided to have another crack at an invasion, amassing thousands of troops across the border, and after James recovered from measles, set sail on March the 17th, 1708. So, why don't we hear of the rising of 1708? Because it descended into farce when a captain got lost and missed his turning for the Firth of Forth, and instead tried to go to the Moray Firth near Inverness before giving up after 2 days of skirmishes and returning back to France. There had been utter panic in London at hearing of a new Jacobite attempt to seize the throne, but all this had done was make the Jacobites look incompetent. The few that rose in Scotland were arrested and jailed, but ended up being acquitted of treason, given that all they'd ever done was toast the pretender over the water in the eyes of the current regime, which was hardly a hanging offence to the public. The Jacobites also tried in 1708 to gain an army to rise in Ireland. Ireland had been chafing under the predominantly anti-Catholic rule of England, and despite the outcome of the war being over 15 years ago, there were still Jacobite faithful within the Emerald Isle. Envoys were sent, but this came to naught. But there is evidence it was taken seriously as a threat by England, and a serious mission by the Jacobites. Despite these challenges, the reign of Queen Anne was a relatively peaceful and prosperous one on the domestic front. However, war continued to rage in Europe as the Spanish succession battle dragged on. Battle raged and British men died. Even James Francis Edward Stuart fought under King Louis at Oudenarde and Malplaquet. Anne herself hated the war by the time, with its bloodshed and its high cost turning public opinion against them. The public also resented the prizes being lavished on the Duke of Marlborough, commander of the army whose wife was one of Anne's favourites. But she'd begun to fawn over Abigail Masham instead as Marlborough fell from favour. Incidentally, for those of you who've seen The Favourite and its depiction of Anne's alleged lesbian affairs, a lot of that is based on a lot of Whig rumour and smear campaigning. And no, Anne didn't keep a bunch of pet rabbits. Added to the war troubles was the trial of Dr. Henry Sacheverell, a preacher who'd railed against the government and its tolerance of non-C of E faiths. He was tried on treason against the government, convicted, but given the light sentence of a 3-year preaching ban, which people cheered. They loved Sacheverell, and they abhorred the heavy-handed autocratic response of the Whig Party. In the elections of 1710, the Tory opponents formed the new administration. Their first act was to open secret negotiations with James in Saint-Germain to possibly offer him the succession of the throne to Anne, to ensure that the Hanoverians, seen as foreign interlopers, would not get the throne. There ended up being two problems with this particular negotiation. One, James again refused to renounce his Catholic faith, and two, he thought the offer came from Anne and ended up writing a letter to her stating that it was only political machinations and other people plotting that kept the family apart. He professed that he loved his half-sister and that their father had never stopped loving her, and would she possibly consider letting him have the throne? That he received no reply probably indicated that the offer had fallen somewhat on deaf ears. Eventually, the Tories cut off negotiations with James as pointless, seeing that they would go nowhere, and they instead decided to negotiate a peace with France and end this interminable war of the Spanish succession. The Treaty of Utrecht was signed in 1711 to end the war and stem the bleeding of British money and troops. Army troop numbers were to be reduced, and Britain was forced to abandon her European allies, including the Hanoverians. Another article in the treaty was that James III and VIII was to be expelled from France. He left, seeking asylum in the independent Duchy of Lorraine. He wrote to Louis XIV in February 1713, thanking him profusely for his help and support, and hoping that this would continue in any future ventures. James had been shaken previously by the death of his younger sister, Louisa Maria, and now with the added stress of having to be parted from his mother, she was said to be absolutely inconsolable. But James was said to be happy but not merry, and somewhat morose. James was out of favour and left with his courtiers in a new country to build from the beginning all over again. Queen Anne was not much longer for the world, dying on August the 1st, 1714, of a stroke at the age of 45. Her death marked the last of the House of Stuart the British Parliament would allow to take the throne. History hasn't been kind to Anne. It's portrayed her as a sort of chubby, frumpy placeholder between William and Mary and the Hanoverians, notable only for lending her name to a type of furniture. But I think that's unfair. I think Anne presided over a constitutionally volatile time. It led to the creation of a brand new nation. She was a queen who wanted to involve herself in government as much as her health would allow, and she presided over a very stable domestic administration, even if she was beset by wars in Europe and threats of a continual Jacobite revolt. Next time, we shall leave the authorised House of Stuart and welcome the arrival in Britain of the House of Hanover. Although far from cementing safe rule in Britain, bringing in foreign rulers would once again push some in the country to anger, and from there, we will see that they go into open revolt to restore the Jacobite king.